Welcome to the War and Diplomacy podcast, produced by the Centre for War and Diplomacy at Lancaster University. The CWD provides the historical context and strategic analysis to inform understanding of today's geopolitical challenges, promoting discussion through research, teaching, consultancy, and public events.
Hello, I'm Nick Coombs, a former British diplomat, and now with Lancaster University's Centre for War and Diplomacy. And I'm delighted to introduce today Simon Collis, former colleague and great friend, who has recently finished being Her Majesty's Ambassador to Saudi Arabia and was previously the British Ambassador to Qatar, Syria and Iraq. And I thought what I wanted to explore today a bit was picking up on the Centre's own title, War and Diplomacy. What is it that we as Westerners, non-Arabs, non-locals, are seeking to achieve in the region and why? What we call war, and there are lots of different kinds of war. So, for example, Mohammed bin Zayed in Abu Dhabi talks of the new wars of religion in the region. King of Jordan talks about a Shia crescent spreading over. Is sectarianism at the root of this, or is it part of it? We, from our external perspective, talk in rather grand terms about the war on terror, otherwise known as Operation Enduring Freedom, the invasion of Iraq, known as Operation Iraqi Freedom. So we clearly have a perception and an agenda. And I thought it'd be interesting to talk that through with Simon, given the places he's been. And I was reminded as I was putting these notes together of the very famous quote that is often used from Lawrence of Arabia, which sounds rather patronizing in the first part, but is quite telling in all three parts. Better the Arabs do it tolerably than you do it perfectly. Crucially then, it is their war and you are to help them, not win it for them. And I thought I might use that as a start point and hand over to Simon.
Well, thank you, Nick, and thanks for the invitation. And of course, the third part of that Lawrence dictum was actually also under the very odd conditions of Arabia, your practical work will not be as good as perhaps you think it is. And I think that injunction to modesty is very necessary, probably anywhere in diplomacy, but certainly in the Middle East. And I also like his use of the term practical work. He was thinking of conflict, but I think it also applies to diplomacy and the diplomatic approach to handling a pre-conflict or post-conflict situation. It's good to think of it as practical work, not as a profession, but more as a trade.
That makes perfect sense. I mean, I wonder if, given the chronology of your history of postings, we might then start with your arrival in Syria and take the narrative from there.
So I arrived in Damascus in late 2007, November 2007, which you'll recall was just as Obama had been elected but and was in transition. He hadn't yet taken up office. So a bit of a parallel to where we are right now. And the Syrian regime was highly focused on Iraq and the US and coalition intervention in Iraq, which had begun 3 years earlier, and which had been accompanied by comments from, you know, the neocons in the Bush administration, people like Cheney, Rumsfeld, that to the effect that after they had sorted out Iraq, Syria and Iran were going to be next. Yeah. And as one Iraqi governor observed to a visiting British general and me, governor of one of the southern states, he said, of course, if you're going to go into somebody's house and take control of it and you want the neighbours to help you, it's not a good idea to tell them that they're next. So the Syrian regime had been doing what it could to ensure that the coalition's experience in Iraq was as painful and expensive as they could make it, so that they would be less inclined to try it again somewhere else. And that included not just turning a blind eye to foreign fighters traveling through, arriving into Damascus Airport and traveling through Syria and crossing the border into Iraq, but active facilitation of those networks. So when I arrived, there was no American ambassador. There hadn't been for some time. There was an American chargé who had very limited access to the system. He was allowed to talk to the head of protocol and the head of the Americas department, who were actually married to each other, and very occasionally to the late Waleed Mualim's private secretary. I had a bit more access than that, and I tried to use it at the beginning to say, look, you know, I don't condone what you have been doing, but I can see why you were doing it on a personal level. But the fact is, you don't need to do it anymore. And maybe you would like to look at options to re-engage with the West, carefully and cautiously on both sides. And they made the right noises about that, but they never really acted on it. And incident right at the beginning of my term that kind of set the tone for what happened after, I felt, which was, I was due to present my credentials. This is the formal moment when you present the documents that the Queen has signed to the head of state of the country to which you're accredited. So I went up to the palace where Bashar al-Assad received his formal visitors. And it's a sort of post-fascist architecture, Mussolini-type architecture, the building. And the signpost towards it says in English, it says Presidential Palace this way. But in Arabic, it says Qasr al-Shab, the People's Palace, which is a kind of standing joke amongst Damascenes, cynical at its remoteness. Anyway, we went up to this mountain perch above the city, and I was in a antechamber with the Minister for Presidential Affairs, who was kind of sizing me up before the ceremony with the president. And as part of his opening conversation, he's dropped in as an observation. He said, as you know, Ambassador, we have freedom in Syria. And I felt a fork in the road open up in front of me, because if I had left that remark unchallenged, at the start of my term, pretty much every other transaction I was due to have with Syrian authorities would have been based on this false assertion that there was freedom. But equally, if I challenged it, well, what was that going to do to set the tone for the ceremonies at the start of my tenure? Anyway, I was reminded of the Vaclav Havel comment that, you know, it begins with a lie, it begins with a small lie, yes. And then one thing leads to another. So I did challenge it. And he sort of said, well, yes, it's true. Yes, we are arresting bloggers and we are, you know, shutting down TV channels. And yes, we are doing this, that and the other. But that is because we have a state of emergency because of the frozen conflict with the Zionist entity, with Israel, which, of course, had been the regime's justification for many years for its authoritarian approach. And then I was able to say, OK, well, you know, we've agreed that that's the situation, and I'm happy to have a conversation with you about why. So I think, you know, from the beginning, you have to be ready to challenge, and particularly in an authoritarian state, if you're dealing with its leadership. I don't want to sound too, you know, bold about this, but if you are a diplomat with immunity, you are actually one of the very, very few people for whom it is a relatively risk-free opportunity. You have a certain amount of access, more than many, and you work on improving it. And it's important to use that access. You're not there just to kind of exchange what you could read about each other's formal positions. You have to try and push boundaries and explore them. And you do that, you know, the phrase goes to speaking truth to power. But yeah, actually, it is, that is what you should aim to do, to be as clear as you can, as carefully as you can, and then explore where you go, where you might mutually go in building a relationship or in avoiding a conflict or in resolving particular short-term problems on an arising basis. But unless you have the access and the contacts and the readiness to use them, then you don't get to the start line.
And of course, it's a fascinating element of that. I mean, I agree with all of that. That makes perfect sense. And it can be a very challenging moment. And sometimes with your interlocutors to say, well, yes, I can see you have an external foreign problem that you perceive, but actually you're using it as a justification for something else. But in somewhere like Syria, where the situation was immensely complex on the ground, dealing with some very difficult individuals at the government level, but at a strategic international level, the narrative was that people are trying to crush Sunni Islamic fundamentalism, terrorism, Daesh. You've got various interventions from the Turks and the Russians coming along. You've got the Saudis trying to influence Damascus as well. Lots and lots of moving parts. At what point do you get a sense that it becomes difficult for a diplomat to judge whether one kind of war or intervention is more worthy or better, or do you compromise and chip away at those values because of the bigger picture?
Good question. I think, so when you're a practicing diplomat on the ground, one of the ways you add value to your own government is by focusing on what's in front of you. There are plenty of people back in London who, or in other capitals typically, who will do the grand strategy piece and see it all in that big regional context. And of course, you know, if you're going to be effective, you have to have good awareness of that, and where necessary, should aim to shape it. But actually, one of the things you can do as a diplomat on the ground, hopefully, is help your own capital to move beyond abstract concepts, or at least to apply those concepts in a realistic way to the reality on the ground.
Yeah.
And it's possible that if you look at the Bush administration's approach to Iraq in the run-up to 2004,
yeah.
It sometimes seemed to me that it was a bit like perhaps the British Raj's approach to conflict in the late 19th century.
Yeah.
In the sense that, what do I mean by that? I mean that in each case, you perhaps had a power which was so unchallenged militarily, in the US case because of, you know, the Air Force and all the rest of it, all the other capabilities. Back in the 19th century, it was the Royal Navy, which was, you know, the unrivaled ability to project force.
Yeah.
And there was a risk in those situations that the decision makers in the capital would focus only on what they wanted. The debate would be an internal debate within the system, because the assumption would be that whatever was decided there, there was the capability to impose that reality.
Yeah.
on the ground. And you know, people learn the hard way that that is easier said than done, even if you think you have overwhelming force. It's not only the Bush administration in recent times or its coalition partners, including the UK. There has been, I think, throughout history, perhaps, a tendency by generals, who by their nature tend to be optimistic people, can-do people, to, you know, in the modern era, to say, in effect, you know, whatever the operation is, we can do this in 90 days and mostly from the air. And it's never as short as that, and it's never as clean as that, and there's always an aftermath, which is always much, much more difficult than anybody ever imagined, even if they do the hard work on scenarios. So, yeah, I think that there is a role when you are on the ground to try and help the capital understand, here is the ground truth, here is the reality. And if we are going to influence events, you know, here's what it looks like from where we sit. And of course, in Syria, the West was always very careful not to commit to intervention. The onset of the uprising in Syria had nothing to do with the Western intervention. There was actually a Western policy, as I say, certainly a UK and eventually an American ambassador did arrive in Damascus, and his goal was also to try and build a relationship with the regime that we found there, to encourage them to step away from their near exclusive reliance on relationships with Iran or with Russia.
Yep.
To become more of a, you know, to stop supporting the non-state actors around the region through the arc of resistance, to stop dabbling that way, and to behave more like a normal government in a normal country, responsible for maintaining security within its borders and contributing to regional stability that way, and taking them seriously and their point of view seriously on the issues that concerned them, whether it was Iraq or the Arab-Israel dispute or Lebanon. So this approach was designed to engage. It didn't involve threats. It did involve sometimes saying your decisions have consequences,
yes,
but it didn't involve threats. And the uprising, which had begun in Tunisia and Egypt before it began in Syria, was a genuinely popular uprising. And, you know, most of my conversations with regime officials during the months that followed began with a reaffirmation that, you know, what you have is a Syrian-Syrian problem. It's not a Syria-West problem.
Yes.
And when you threaten us, when you say to us, if it blows up here, it will have huge regional consequences, our response, my response was to say, yes, we know, we understand. We are very concerned that it should not. And with the opposition, we were always very careful not to commit to a military intervention. It raises questions about what are the standards when you do intervene and when you don't intervene. But I think, you know, the Washington and London were both carrying the scars of the failed intervention in Iraq. And so, you know, there was a sense that a Western intervention was, you know, people were concerned about the legality, but also the practicality and likelihood of success. And there was a lot of caution, about engaging in that. So the idea that this was a Western conspiracy, CIA Zionist conspiracy, as the Syrian security services and leadership claimed, was just nonsense. Yeah. And all Syrians knew it was nonsense.
I mean, it's interesting talking there about the using the word intervention or invasion, as it was with Iraq, because I can remember actually when you and I were on posting together in Amman in Jordan, and I spent a lot of time talking to the Iraqi opposition in exile in Jordan. And the thing they wanted above all else for their generals was British troops, American troops, tanks, invasion. They wanted us to invade. We remember that a lot of the intelligence that got supplied to the justifications was all in support of encouraging some kind of military intervention. Then, of course, we did intervene. We went in with Operation Iraqi Freedom. And many of us, the older Camel Corps Arabists, had said this will open up a can of worms, and it gives no satisfaction to say that it did. But those very same Arab leaders who were part of the opposition calling on military intervention from the West because it would achieve their immediate objective of getting rid of Saddam Hussein, then of course find themselves in government looking at a sectarian nightmare. And I think you found yourself in the governorate of Basra fairly shortly afterwards. So I think it's a logical step there to look at that way in which intervention and sectarianism get tangled up.
Yes, well thanks. I think, you know, there were... It's a question still in my mind to what extent some of the regional players that felt threatened by the Saddam regime, which, you know, let's remember, had been systematically a destabilizing force across the region and highly repressive within the country. The failure of Iraq as a state began with Saddam's rise, you know, not didn't begin in 2004, although that made it much worse. I think some of the regional leaders maybe were concerned, you know, that maybe they took it as a given that there was going to be some kind of Western pressure, because after the Kuwait war in 91 and a decade of sanctions, yes, which in it had the result of, in effect, strengthening the Saddam regime at the expense of the misery of ordinary Iraqis. And so I think some of the regional leaders felt, well, if this was unsustainable and there was going to be a further evolution of this, then they wanted to shape it. So maybe they were dealing with what they thought was going to happen anyway. And the question was not whether, but how. And their goal, their advice, mostly turned on a limited decapitation.
Yes.
Of the top layer of the regime, but nothing deeper than that. And of course, that's pretty much the opposite of what happened, because Paul Bremer issued those two decrees early on, disbanding Ba'ath Party and dismissing people down to relatively low levels from their positions. So a whole range of people who actually ran the state, ran the country, you know, senior engineers in power generation or whatever, who had been required to join the party in effect for career advancement terms, not because of any ideology, and they certainly weren't associated with. Yeah, and these people found themselves sacked. So who was going to run the country then? Who was going to keep things moving? And then on top of that, the disbandment of the armed forces meant that you know all of these formed units of men who, you know, military age males who knew how to fight, who had trained together, and were being told, you know, you're losing your job. But not just that, with that, you know, you're losing your housing, you're losing your pension. And what do you expect these guys to do if they're not part of the future of the new Iraq? Well, they're going to resist it. And they did. And that was perfectly obvious. I was Consul General in Dubai at the time. And there were senior people there who, it was perfectly obvious to all of us, Westerners familiar with the region and people who lived in it, that way would be a disaster. And so I guess one of the what if questions is whether, if the intervention had been carried out with less arrogance and incompetence than it was, whether the outcome might have been different, whether the collapse of the state and the rise of the militias and the sectarianism might have been avoided. I mean, who knows? I'm personally doubtful about it. It probably wouldn't have been quite as bad as it was, but I'm not sure that would have been enough to set the conditions for a successful transition.
And it makes us come back again to that sort of bigger thing of, should we do this? You know, who are we? Yeah. Now, you and I have spent enough time rattling around the diplomatic world to know that we sort of bought into the international way in which people relate to each other. And let's face it, the British have been doing interventions all over the place for years and years and years, for good or ill. But there is this sort of almost expectation from the Arab world and almost absence of questioning from the Western world that, well, this is what we do. And I'm very conscious from my own diplomatic experience that if you ever sort of suddenly go, well, going back to the Lawrence quote, you know, it's their war and we're to help them, not win it for them. But actually, that isn't always the case, is it? Because, you know, when one of the key reasons, justifications of an international, strategic, and very important domestic protection level for invading Iraq, allegedly, never mind the weapons of mass destruction, but was in the end to try to keep control over Islamic State. Now, I suppose, actually, I'm getting myself a bit ahead of myself there, because the rise of Islamic State in Iraq was probably a consequence of the invasion rather than the justification. But a consequence of that intervention was an appalling opening of a sectarian can. And I'd sort of, going back to the Mohammed bin Zayed quote about facing the new wars of religion in the region, do we buy into that? Is that true in all places?
Well, to take the last question first, I think I tend to see sectarianism as what happens when there is a failure of governance.
Yes.
We can discuss it. You can cut it quite a lot of ways in a chicken and egg sense. You know, is sectarianism the cause of instability, or is it the consequence of governance failure, the failure of institutions in nation states to keep order with their borders and build institutions and build law? And I think it's a bit of both, frankly. Clearly, the sectarian tensions have been there at different times through history. But you can look at European medieval history and the wars of religion in Europe. You know, it was the construction of the Westphalian state system that managed to mitigate the different religious pressures, both within states and between states or statelets. And I think that's some of that is applicable to the Middle East region. Of course, one has to be careful, you know, different contexts. But some of it, I think there is a read across.
Yeah.
And more importantly, Arab friends who are familiar with Europe's history often draw the same conclusion. They draw the same parallel. I think going to your first point, absolutely, that there has been one of the failures of Western diplomacy and engagement with the region has been the inadequacy of recognizing the agency of actors in the region. And of course that happens, you know, that is a feature of people who live there as well, some of them. You know, I lost count of the number of conversations I had with Arab friends over meals, where, you know, they would talk about the historic responsibility of the British or the French or whatever, going back to the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, or actually blaming the Turks for the Ottoman injustices, and then the Mandate period with Britain and France. And you sort of tried to gently point out that the number of years that had elapsed since the end of the Mandate period far exceed the duration of the Mandate itself. So whatever bad decisions were made during that time, or consequential, you know, decisions taken without due regard to the longer term consequences, and they were often taken by well-intentioned people under the pressure of events. But whatever one's view of that, surely there comes a point at which leaders and elites and populations within countries can take responsibility for fixing whatever was wrong. And you can look at examples from other post-conflict societies. So, you know, just to take one example, after the Second World War, Germany and Japan and the reconstruction. I mean, the occupation in both of those countries went far beyond anything that the colonial powers undertook in the Middle East. Yeah. And of course, one would say that it was done by their own people, at a crucial difference rather than by an invader. But the fact is, in the post-conflict environment, people were able to sort of pick up and sort themselves out. And I think there has been a tendency not to, you know, some of it is what Edward Said referred to, you know, the Orientalism, the patronizing approach there. But even the Orientalist critique can be taken too far, because it can be a bit of a cop-out. It's like, well, fine, up to a point, but what are you able to do about it now? And how can we support you or work with you or partner you? And, you know, at the end of the day, if you're a British diplomat anywhere, your job is to represent British interests, not, you know, design the world. And what are those interests? Well, typically they are a mix of security, prosperity and values. You know, you want there to be enough security and stability that there are governments that can be held accountable for what goes on in their region and deal with each other and deal with us and the wider world, be part of the community of nations, part of an international order. On the back of that stability, you want to promote trade and investment, both because that's good for development in those countries, but, you know, stronger trading partners is good for jobs and trade and profits in the UK. It's win-win paradigm. And values, obviously including human rights values. And those three broad objectives are sometimes in tension. Of course they are. We like to pretend that they're reconcilable. I think the attempt to reconcile them is necessary and honourable. That does involve making compromises.
Yes.
And as far as human rights and values goes, it can involve, well, I would put two things out there. One is first do no harm.
Yes.
First, do no harm, which is actually quite a key point for, you know, across a whole range of things. But secondly, to remember that whilst we do have values, and whilst we do consider many of those values to be universal, although some may find different expression in different historical contexts, that's not just an Orientalist point. It's a You look at the history of Britain and France, you know, we're both liberal democracies with institutions and state of law, but we got there by quite different routes historically.
Yeah.
So there's a need sometimes just to remind ourselves that we are not an international rights NGO. If you're a British diplomat, support for human rights is part of what you stand for, and you should always be clear about that. But you're not you know, it's not the only thing. It's not the only thing. And managing that is challenging and unsatisfactory and the sort of thing that keeps you awake at night. But in the end, that's necessary. And you need to do it with an eye on not what makes you feel good or looks good back home, or what will be, you know, allow you to engage in virtue signaling.
Yeah.
You really need to do it with an eye to what can help make an incremental difference on the ground.
It is a classic part of the diplomatic approach, isn't it? Because there's an ultimate question you can ask, well, who's keeping score? Is it the United Nations? Is it your own government? Is it which changes? Is it the European Union? Is it mankind in the biggest... You know, there isn't any central point that's got a nice list of virtue and merit ranking all the countries around the world.
So I think when you're a British diplomat, you need to be very clear about who's keeping score, and that is the Foreign Secretary and the Prime Minister. It's not the United Nations. I never worked for the United Nations. We value the UN and it exists. We help create it. We need to see it adapt to the challenges that have grown up since that world order was first put in place in the late 1940s.
Yeah,
so it's not a static thing. And you know, whilst it's incredibly valued and in different places, I've worked very closely with UN counterparts in Syria, in Iraq, elsewhere. They are key partners, but I don't work for the UN. I worked for the British government, and it's the British government's policies, which I am paid to, first of all, advise on what those policies should be, and secondly, to, you know, loyally deliver. And if you can't do that, then you need to resign.
Exactly. No, I'm well put. And I think drawing this conversation to a sort of close at this point, it'd be fascinating to pick it up again if we have the chance. Just looking at the final posting you had in Saudi Arabia, I'm not going to ask about the subject we've already covered in terms of, you know, human rights and all that. And there's a whole podcast one could have on that. But going right back to that sort of point that Mohammed bin Zayed was making about the wars of religion, Shia, Sunni, the Saudi position, the United Arab Emirates position, predominantly seems to be based at the moment on the anxiety about fear of Iran. And certainly in the Western response, and we've seen it under the Trump administration with Biden now coming in transition, the ways in which different parts of the world wish to engage with or contain or deal with Iran. Do you think that the Saudi heart is really in the sectarian argument on this, or is it a power struggle?
Yeah, another really good question, Nick. I've heard Saudi leaders say very clearly on regular occasions that their problem is not with Iran as such. And they point out that there have been periods in the past when they have had good relations with Iran. The problem they have is with post-revolutionary, post-1979 revolutionary Iran.
Yeah.
And it's explicitly sectarian agenda. In its constitution, and its explicit commitment to exporting that revolution around the region, and the steps that it has taken in practice to do so, resulting in, you know, Iranian politicians sometimes boasting that they now control four Arab capitals,
yes,
Beirut, Damascus, Baghdad, and Sana'a in Yemen. So, you know, this isn't an imaginary thing. This is a real thing. And part of the challenge for Western diplomacy in the next phase, and, you know, as we speak, Joe Biden is preparing his transition, and Tony Blinken has been selected as Secretary of State, and he was much involved in putting together the nuclear deal with Iran during the Obama administration.
Yep.
That nuclear deal tackled the nuclear threat, but it did not tackle the regional security issues. And so, you know, Iran was, or indeed ballistic missile proliferation. So Iran was free to continue and did so. I think in Riyadh or in Abu Dhabi, the leaderships, when they look around the region, they see the threat from Iran, and they see that threat as being one that destabilizes governments within borders and actually erodes borders. And, you know, there's a track record there that speaks for itself in their use of proxy militias, proxy conflict. There's a whole conversation about that. The second threat that they see is the jihadi extremism threat, the terrorist threat, which is a shared threat with the West. So most recently Daesh, before that Al-Qaeda in Iraq, before that Al-Qaeda, and so on. And a third threat, I think some of the interlocutors here would say it's actually part of the second threat, but a third threat is the political Islamism, the Ikhwani Brotherhood organization, which again, in their analysis, seeks to form a state within a state, operates on a cell basis, a bit like communist parties, aims to subvert existing modes of government, and operates across borders as a transnational conspiracy. And in the view of leaders in Riyadh and Abu Dhabi, it acts as a gateway drug to full-on jihadi terrorism. So I think those are the three threats that they see, in which they seek to organize against themselves and against which they will tend to measure partnerships with the West. To what extent do we support their efforts to face these challenges, and to what extent not? And they recognize that isn't always or even mostly going to be about military intervention.
No.
A lot of it is about shaping the political dialogue internationally. It's about tackling ideology and the spread of radical ideologies, including online, cyber. It's about promoting economic and social reforms that give people, especially young people, a sense of optimism and hope about their futures. And we can see this in Saudi Arabia in particular. You know, I arrived the week after King Salman ascended to the throne, and during that 5 years I was there, it saw, you know, the rise of his son, now the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman.
Yep.
And the commitment to, you know, the largest set of political and economic and social reforms, particularly economic and social reform, that the country has seen in a long time, and which was launched pretty much during the first international investor forum that he hosted, when he said, we will go back to a moderate Islam tolerant of other religions.
Yes.
And that, I think, is a key commitment, and one that is very much in the British and wider Western interest to acknowledge and welcome and support.
Simon, thank you very much indeed for your time. The building works in the Middle East in the background, I hope, haven't intruded too much.
Sorry about that. Yeah, it's next door.
But a great pleasure to chat. My thanks from the Centre for War and Diplomacy for your time. And maybe we'll have a chance to do this again in the future. But for now, I'll sign off from here and finish our recording. Many thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Nick. It's a pleasure. Thanks. Thanks very much. Bye.
Thank you for listening. To hear further podcasts, please visit the CWD website, lancaster.ac.uk/CWD. There you can find more on the CWD's research, events and teaching, including the MA in International and Military History.